This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
There's a bit of sunshine out there, but it's going to rain again, but we better get on. Good time to read a book when it's raining. I'm going to start with a little song. I think that I will never see a poem as lovely as a tree. Now, what better way than that to start a discussion on Rhett Davis's latest novel, Arborescence. So, Rhett, welcome in person to 3CR.
Thank you, David.
Now, there's a central couple in this work, Bren and Kaylin. Bren is works at Q Liaison. Can you detail what he does?
Well, I mean, part of the difficulty is he doesn't really know what he does to some extent. So he works at a company called The Q. He works remotely, and he's a Q liaison. And basically what that means is he just gets kind of a variety of tasks from a central kind of server somewhere that says, here, do this. And it can be a bit of copywriting, could be a bit of programming, it could be sort of inventing some sort of, or making an image of something, lots of different kind of technical sort of things he can do. But the point is he's very, he doesn't really know anyone in this company. He's completely remote from it.
I don't know much about the company I work for. I joined 3 years ago, 6 months after graduating. They don't have a physical address, and I've never met anyone in person. Mm. But what's that saying about the nature of the workforce today?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the work that I've done, I've worked in the sort of technical space, not in a dissimilar space to Brent to some extent, probably not as exaggerated as that, but a lot of it is still remote and has been remote and can be done remotely, particularly over the COVID times. It was very sort of distancing, I suppose.
But he doesn't know if his work is actually being received, appreciated.
Right.
It's just sort of in the ether.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a nod, to the increasing use of AI in sort of work. This is slightly speculative, obviously, as a novel in the way it sort of starts to explore these kind of issues, but it's getting to the point where it really is a sense that we don't really know if anyone is real in this work.
Here's a discourse between him and his co-worker. My co-worker, whose name is Ali, asks what my relationship with my brother is like. I've never had an interaction with Ali that isn't confusing. I ask her how they knew about Travis. It's on your profile, they message. No, it's not, I reply. Not yours, another person's. Right, I type. I don't feel comfortable talking about this with a co-worker I've never met in person. This is a safe space, Bren. Yeah, look, I just want to find out about the status of the work package. Hey, have you heard about Formstein? It's weird how you keep sending me links to strange shit I've never heard of without context, Ali. I'm not going to click your links. I thought this was a safe space, Bren. I mean, does Ali actually exist?
You'll have to find out. You have to work that out yourself, really, David. Look, I think the implication is fairly strong that she maybe does not exist in any real human sense.
But the hint is there in it's on your profile. No, it's not. No, another person's.
Yeah, so there's a hint that she's sort of, or whatever it is that is responding on the other sort of area is possibly adapting to
yeah, but
to what
we're picking
saying,
up but, information sure. via algorithms yeah. of people, via a message of a message sort of thing. And so all of that information is being gleaned and garnered to find...
And there's a sense that I think these, whatever these entities are that he's kind of working with, are sort of trying to sell him things too. So it's a weird sort of corporate kind of mishmash, I suppose, of what's going on with what he's doing. But he's still getting stuff done and he's still getting paid to do it, so he keeps doing it.
So it says a lot about the nature of work. But let's get on to Kaylin. Kaylin, on the other hand, is struggling to find employment. She's had 16 jobs in our 4 years together, says Bren. But she takes an interest in watching tree cult videos. And this is where the story takes an interesting turn. And she actually writes an article on what she discovers these people are doing, because having watched these videos on YouTube, there are people standing in a field being trees. In a barren field beside an old growth forest, down an old logging road, 33 people face east and believe they are becoming trees. I don't mean that they wake up and decide to be a tree for the day and then go home. I mean that they have stood in the same place for weeks on end, barely eating, barely drinking, trusting that they will soak up the nutrients provided by the sun, the earth, and the air. I stand before them, challenging them, daring them to move, but they don't. Within a few moments, a voice asks me to give the seedlings space to bathe in soul's total light for as long as the day will allow. But this becomes Kaylin's whole focus. And what does she discover?
Well, Kaylin, first of all, is a very... at the start of the book, she's a very ambitious person who doesn't know where to put that ambition. So she's clearly thinking she wants to be something or do something, but she's finding it very hard to find out what that actually is. And so, yes, she comes across this kind of video of a tree cult, I suppose. She's had an interest in plants, and suddenly this becomes a kind of an obsession for her, and she thinks that maybe something might come of this. Quite why she decides that's the case. I mean, it's quite a fascinating idea. I'd be interested in it if it actually was happening. So maybe it's self-explanatory. But she just goes with it, and she really starts to uncover more of what's going on in this community, which gets even stranger, I suppose,
as the novel progresses. But at this point, you've got Bran and Kaylin almost representing diametrically opposing forces in society. I mean, that digital age of disconnection as opposed to those seeking a higher purpose.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, at a basic level with this, with the novel, it's sort of a bit of a, it's me thinking about how far I want to take technology myself as an individual, right? You know, we're sort of at this point where technology feels like it's going to get out of control for us all, right? With the way AI is going and so forth. And where we actually start turning back to the real world and nature a little bit more. That's really what I was kind of playing with a little bit with this.
So what
with the two of them.
Yeah, what are you saying about society overall?
I never try to be too sort of didactic with it. It's a pretty much I think where, if I'm honest, I think the move towards AI is not particularly comforting. I mean that's not rocket science. Most people probably think that way unless you're actually trying to sell it. But I think we're moving away from. I think the main thing with this is that it's thinking about the types of people who are spruiking this sort of stuff, and who actually benefits from this. Do we as a society, does the earth benefit from this stuff? Probably not. And so when do we actually start to really seriously address some of the things that some of the earth related issues that we really should be focusing on? We all acknowledge are existing, but we keep kind of getting seduced by horrible technology, I think.
Well, you know, I'd have listeners know that we work out of an old analog studio with dials rather than digital things. And we actually have a policy, published or not, of inviting authors to come in. It's the interpersonal is so vital for that spontaneity. And yet with AI, we're starting to lose that, to the extent where Bren didn't know if he was talking to Ali or not.
Yeah, and even with the remote working sometimes too, that even with all your Zooms and so forth, it can be very alienating, I think. And it's not suggesting we all need to get back to the office, but it's because I know that's controversial too. But we have lost a lot of the interpersonal, for sure.
But now you take this to an absurd level. Who is Umlaut?
So Umlaut is an employer that Bren ends up working for, I suppose. And how do I summarize this in a couple of seconds? Umlaut is effectively is an AI who employs human actors to act as him. It's almost like an agent of him in the real world. So in a reversal, I suppose, of what might happen. And he's not a particularly nice employer either, has to be said.
Well, soon we will transcend the need for human employment. But Umlaut comes knocking later on in the book.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of he gets to a point where obviously things going as they do in this book, society starts to go a little bit strange, and there's a lot of the support mechanisms, you know, for an AI such as electricity start to fail a little bit, and so these sort of entities sort of might start to struggle in that environment.
Getting back to Kaylin, then she takes an interest in arborescence. She's initially derided for this interest, but as the trend develops, as more people become interested in basically becoming trees, she becomes an expert, an academic, and a sought-after speaker. And she's talking about the whole social contract that people have, and that this is going to form, with people sort of trying to re-engage in a totally different way.
Yes. So, yeah, she does. She does go that way. She starts to adopt some fairly controversial sort of views too, I think, and that's really where Brennan Kaelin's kind of relationship comes under the microscope a little bit. She certainly has benefited from engaging with this sort of strange topic early, and then when actually things start to happen quite seriously, she does become the expert. But she is, I guess, trying to sort of underline a little bit of how, you know, whether this could be a good thing or not for people to actually turn into trees. And that's kind of one of the central questions, I suppose, that the book sort of asks.
It begs then, well, a lot of interesting questions. I mean, what is the social contract that we have today as a community?
Yeah.
The nature of employment and its meaning. Does it have any?
And I suppose the nature of sort of some sort of level of, you know, what do we give up? If we are to fix this situation we find ourselves in the world with climate and so forth, what are we prepared to actually sacrifice for it? And are we prepared to sacrifice anything? Do we continue down this sort of line of just consuming and consuming? Look, that's not a question the book can answer, obviously, but it's me just exploring, I suppose, what that might look like.
But you love taking it to an absurd level. By merely existing, you have disturbed the planet. You are part of the problem. How much are we the problem?
Well, I mean, I think that's true if you look at it in a really sort of, you know, objective sort of way. But more to the point, I think it's more about impact. You know, how can we, if we look at it in a more sort of gentle sort of way, how do we reduce that impact that we have? I mean, that's just a basic sort of conservation idea, I suppose. But yeah.
And getting into the way you've written this book, there's a series of sections that are then compiled of vignettes to the point where some of these vignettes are one line long.
Yep.
There are too many ways we can pretend we're not here. It's almost poetic.
Poetic. I like that line. Thank you. look, yeah, it was pretty deliberate. I think, first of all, taking a lot of inspiration from Jenny Offal, who wrote Department of Speculation and Weather a few years back. Very fragmented sort of short paragraphs that form and quite short books that form this incredible sort of description of a marriage, or, you know, over time. And it's an effect that I really love. I love those short sort of, and there's a bit of variety in this, but yeah.
Well, that poetic line, it basically resonates. It gives you something to think about.
And it breaks up, I think, some of the, it can sort of surprise as you're going through. And I love books that do that. I mean, that kind of, the narrative just kind of gets a little bit disjointed halfway through with one of these little lines that appears out of nowhere about a cat or something like that. That's very much a deliberate kind of act to sort of just disrupt it a little bit.
Yes, we haven't got time to talk about the cat, unfortunately.
No, it's okay.
But again, analogies, connections. I mean, she stands with her hand on her hip. We looked at each other so often over so many years, but she's not the person I knew. She's grown and twisted the way trees sometimes do in response to something disturbing their growth. So there is an analogy drawn between people and trees and the way we behave.
Yeah, there is. It's a tough one to unpack for me. The idea of it being a direct sort of metaphor is something I resist a little bit. It's something I just kind of like to, you know, have there as a bit of an association that you can kind of do what you want with.
Last but not least, after all the absurdity, there's something that holds this whole thing together on a very human level. Brennan Kaelin, they have a relationship. It falls or starts to disintegrate. It comes together again. And so in many ways, that's the undercurrent.
Yeah.
Human undercurrent.
I think so. I think effectively it is for me. It started off as a love story, really. It just happens to be that people might be turning into trees in the middle of it as well. But the actual love story is very much there. They're in love at the start. Maybe they aren't at the end, but you know.
But it's a counterpoint to all of the absurdity.
I agree.
It's a very real human thing.
It's centering the whole thing. Yep.
So basically, listeners are going to have to go out and hug a tree after to read Arborescence. The author is Rhett Davis, and it's a Hachette release, Jan.
Oh, wow. Society. Well, in classrooms, as well as society, there are the sporty ones, the popular ones, the leaders, and the quiet ones who often get overlooked. This is the case in Joe Dobrowski's book, The Making of Martha Mayfield. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Jan.
Now, Martha Mayfield is your main character. Mm-hmm. Which category does she belong in?
Oh, she's definitely one of the quiet ones. Yes, she's definitely a quiet kid for sure.
Martha is 11 years old and hides behind a fringe curtain mm-hmm. and walks down a street as if she has blinkers on, no eye contact, so not necessary to make conversation with anyone. What happens when she does?
She finds it difficult to talk to people that she doesn't know. And so she has a few key people in her life that she's comfortable with, but generally with strangers and with adults, she's uncomfortable.
You describe the blush of her coming up.
Oh, yes.
And what colour does it come out as?
Yes, yes. The colour of salmon sashimi. And that's something that she has in common with her mum. Yeah.
Martha has a big sister, Iris, and this big sister is summed up so beautifully.
Okay, so this is from early on in the book. Martha describes, says, "Ever since the start of year 10, when Mum told Iris she was allowed to start going on dates, Iris has treated dating like a hobby. She collects boyfriends like Pokemon cards. It's as if she's trying to get a whole set."
And she has a number of boyfriends through this book too.
She does.
But it's often said that about Martha and her mother that apples don't fall far from the tree.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
What I was exploring there was the fact that they're very similar, and Martha's mum is also incredibly shy, and so Martha they're very close and they can really relate to each other, and they're practically, Martha would see herself as a mini Eleanor Mayfield, but then she sort of has to ask herself whether or not she can roll a little from the tree, basically.
As well as shyness, they also share creative outlooks.
Yes. Yes, they do. Martha's mum is a dressmaker, and Martha is able to call her, I think she really does dream of being like a fashion designer and having her own boutique, but she's uncomfortable with calling herself that because she doesn't have a lot of self-confidence. But Martha is also a maker. She doesn't sew, but she does make things from paper. She makes these beautiful, intricate sets, and where she will make a miniature version of her bedroom or her classroom or a cafe that she likes or a bookshop that she's read about in a story or something. And she also makes miniature people, so actual out of paper. She'll have a little miniature her and her mum and all of her teachers and her friends and all, basically all the other people in her life.
And she often uses these as a dramatisation of what she should have done.
Yes.
If she was brave enough, this is what she should have done.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Well, in contrast to her shy mother, there is Stella.
Yeah. So Stella is Martha's grandmother, and yes, she's quite different to the rest of the family. Yeah, she's her paternal grandmother.
Not the classic cuddly grandmother type is
That's
Stella.
Right. Yeah.
And Stella is rather fanatical, as in a real fan of Michelle Obama.
She is, yes. I'll be honest, I'm a big fan of Michelle Obama. But I think the reason I made Stella a big fan of Michelle Obama is because I think that she kind of, not in a way where she looks up to her or wants to be or is inspired by her, more that she actually thinks she's on a level with her, where she used to have, her husband passed away many years earlier, but they used to have a successful hardware business, and she would very much see herself as like the reason for the business's success and the woman behind the man, much like kind of Michelle is. And if it wasn't for Michelle, let's face it, Barrack would never have gotten in, and I think that's how Stella sees herself.
When she's not doing yoga.
When she's not doing yoga, yes. I don't know if Michelle does, but she's got great arms, which she does look up to as well, yeah.
Martha would like people to assume that she was a quiet thinker, not quiet and boring.
Yes.
A new teacher at the school, her teacher, assumes her inability to respond in class or speak up would make her disinterested in a position that is being offered to all grade five students. So what's this position?
So it's the school captain election. So we're at the end of year five and it's time to start voting for next year's grade six for school captains. And Martha's teacher, who comes in at the end of term four because her usual teacher has gone away to have a baby, dismisses Martha basically. And Martha, that along with some other things that have happened, kind of is, that's what makes Martha kind of go, well, you know what, I want to do something different now, maybe I can do that.
The skills necessary for a school captain though.
Of standing up at assembly and speaking, of of the making speeches or of giving school tours, that's definitely the personality traits that Martha doesn't have naturally, and they're things that she isn't, or she also isn't interested in having them. That's not what she's looking to be, which was important to me in the book to sort of explore that area of well, maybe you are quiet, but just because you are quiet doesn't mean that you don't have something to say, but maybe you don't have to say it in this way, in this loud and confident way that the other kids are saying. Maybe there are other ways to make yourself heard, and that's what I really wanted to have Martha explore.
So she has some friends from school.
Yep.
Let's read about them from page 31.
Okay, so this is, she's describing, Alfie is shy and quiet, but not as much as me. He's the regular level of shy, the sort of kid who's quiet when he first meets someone but warms up when he gets to know them. I'm still shy around the people I've known for years. Other than Alfie and Sadie, I can never seem to relax around the kids in my class.
So what does Alfie and Sadie and even her mother and sister say or do when she tells them she's going for school captain?
Well, they're all pretty surprised. Actually, they're pretty surprised and to the level of being shocked and a kind of a quest, are you sure, Martha? Are you sure that you've thought this through? But you don't even like to say here when the teacher calls out the role. You know, they're definitely not supportive, which makes Martha, you know, get her back up a bit as well and think, well, I'll show them, sort of.
You know, through this book, we see how she comes to terms with it all.
Yes.
And grows, because she's always got good ideas.
Yes.
The thing about shyness, though, is I'm not associated with owning dogs. No, I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, okay. Yes, I suppose that's true. Martha desperately wants a dog and her mum doesn't want a dog because dog people are very friendly. So dog people will always go up to other people with dogs and comment on them or want to pat them and then talk about the breed, or my dog does the same thing. And you see people in dog parks always chatting, and that is Martha's mum's worst nightmare, is having to stand in a park and just make small talk with someone that she doesn't know. But Martha would consider making small talk. That's for if she had a dog, that's how much she wants one, basically. Yeah.
And shyness and social media.
Yes.
That's not a match either.
No, that's a whole other show, Jan. If you have me back for another half hour, I won't shut up about social media, because that's an area of modern life, particularly with young people, that I'm really concerned about. And so I couldn't not put it in this, but I don't go on about it too much. And it's more I just wanted to show that just because you say something that you are online doesn't mean you actually are that thing. And I think that can be confusing, particularly for adolescents. It's confusing for me. It's used by adults, but Martha does have a look at it via her sister and also via Stella, who loves a bit of Instagram. Yeah.
I think the mother quote from your book, The Making of Martha Mayfield, social media, it's never a post, it's always a boast.
Yes, that is something that she's read somewhere and she says it a lot. I think that's very true, isn't it? It's hard to, you have to remember that a friend of mine calls it, it's your highlights reel, and that's, no one's ever going to post a picture of themselves just after they've had a huge fight with their husband. So we all have to remember that we're just seeing the good bits.
And the other sort of reading between the lines, some shy people are good at making excuses.
Oh, yes. I think you do have to become good at making excuses, don't you? I know that I am definitely, I would consider myself shy, not as shy as I was when I was a kid. I am probably more the Alfie level, but if I don't warm up, that usually means I just don't like you. But you do have to get good at making excuses, because a lot of social situations just make you incredibly uncomfortable and you think, Christ, I don't want to go to that. And so you're good at, you're very creative with why you can't go to things.
So your shyness, is this the reason for the book?
This is my second middle grade novel, and my first one was about a really sassy girl. And so I deliberately wanted to write something really different. And so obviously the opposite of sassy is really shy. But yes, I didn't have to dig very deep to think about and to remember what it was like to feel uncomfortable in class, or what it's like to be new somewhere or trying to make new friends. But I think there is a spectrum of shyness. So where there's like, you might be right at the end of where it's debilitating and you have real social anxiety, or you might just be a little bit reticent. And I think that no matter where you sit, there are different things that will kind of trigger you and make you more uncomfortable, and everyone's level of shyness is different.
You become a very good listener too, I suppose.
Yes.
Eavesdropper?
Yes, oh. She's an excellent, she's a little spy, isn't she? She's a bit of a sneak.
She does that glass on the wall yes. really well.
Yeah.
She listens to a big sister talking on the phone in a bedroom, and also to the hairdresser next door.
Yes.
Narelle, the hairdresser, gives advice.
Yes.
Stella tells Martha that Narelle is constantly solving her clients' problems. As a hairdresser, she sorts out what's on people's heads and what's inside them.
Yes.
Much cheaper than therapy.
Yes, yes. Yes. That's Narelle is very good at that. Narelle's good at listening, but she's good at talking too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So who are the other neighbours in the street?
Oh, so it is. So we also have on the other side, there's a wine bar, and that's Celeste and Al. And all the neighbours are really kind to Martha, because the idea is that they live above a shop, and their shop isn't actually a shop, but all the other, their businesses or newsagents. So there's a newsagent, and there's a wine bar, and there's a butcher and a yoga studio.
And they all join together to help her when she wants their help.
That's right. Everyone comes together, yeah.
A Milky Way hug.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, you have to read it to find out. And also the idea of a friendship bench. This was a really lovely thing, and I've now learned that it's in quite a few schools.
Yes, it does exist. It's not in Martha's school, but I can't take credit for that. It was in my son's primary school. They had a friendship bench where you could go and sit if you were feeling lonely or needed someone to play with without having to actually ask.
Martha has ideas, but she is shy. Can she show her friends, family and classmates who she really is and what she is capable of? Joe Dabrowski is the author. The Making of Martha Mayfield is her book. And Martha disapproves of her mother's broccoli pasta.
She does.
But you've got a new book
yes.
coming out, and it's yes. called Dear Broccoli.
It is. It's a picture book. It's come out on the same day as The Making of Martha Mayfield, and it is about a boy called Frank who hates broccoli so much that he writes it an angry letter. And surprisingly for Frank, broccoli writes back. And the book is a series of letters between them.
Is it AI?
No.
That's very cool.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
All of the friendship benches, we've got friendship seats in the studio where we sit down and talk to each other. I was talking with Rhett Davis about his book Arborescence, Hachette Release, and
Joe Dabrowski, The Making of Martha Mayfield.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.